pharmacogenetic testing, electroencephalographic EEGs, dexamethasone suppression tests. We've been searching for a laboratory test that can predict medication response for decades. Dr. Andrew Miller thinks we found one, and compared to a genetic panel, it costs pennies on the dollar. Welcome to the Carlyle Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. Mind-body psychiatry sounds a bit ethereal, but what we'll be talking about today is down to earth. It's inflammation, and over the past two decades, it's grown into one of the leading theories of depression. The idea is that inflammatory cytokines, the same immune messengers that make you feel slow, tired, and pretty much miserable when you have the flu, also contribute to depression.
There are lots of theories of depression, but what makes this one interesting is that you can measure it in your practice with a simple blood test, the high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, or CRP. And a handful of controlled trials have found that this CRP predicts antidepressant response. We've seen these fads with biomarkers come and go, and the reason they tend to go away is that few of these biomarkers actually prove useful in a clinical trial. See our recent articles on pharmacogenetic testing for some examples.
And as we made our way through the conference circuit last year, we heard from several mood experts who were using it in their practice. Vladimir Maletic, Mark Rappaport, Daniel Lindquist, and Andrew Miller.
Dr. Rappaport, do you think that checking a C-reactive protein to measure levels of inflammation is ready for prime time in clinical practice?
Well, you know, I think we're at a point from all of the meta-analyses and other studies that suggest that it may be wise. And the reason for doing it is the following. If somebody has a higher CRP, the data suggests that they would be more responsive to dopaminergic agents and not responsive to serotonergic agents. If that's the case, we wouldn't want to start that person on an SSRI. And if we did, then what we're doing is using a treatment that may be less effective and subjecting somebody to 6 to 12 weeks of treatment with the wrong agent at the time.
This month, we interviewed Dr. Miller from Emory University on how to use the inflammatory theory in practice. And here, we bring you some of the highlights from that interview.
Dr. Miller, can you start by telling us, what is inflammation?
Inflammation is the body's natural response to infection or wounding. The inflammatory response is extremely important for survival, but when inflammation becomes persistent, it can do damage to a number of bodily systems and tissues, including the heart, can lead to metabolic changes, can contribute to cancer, neurodegenerative disorders, and also inflammation can change set points in the brain that can ultimately influence behavior.
Is depression an inflammatory illness?
So the simple answer to that is no. What we understand is that about 30% of patients with major depression exhibit increased inflammatory markers, and that data was only recently available. But that percent can increase depending on the sample of depressed patients that you're studying or you're treating. For example, in our treatment-resistant depression study, almost 50% of our patients had increased inflammation.
So tell us what a typical patient with depression who has inflammation might look like in the office.
The prototypical patient would be a patient that has significant anhedonia, patients that may have psychomotor retardation, patients with fatigue.
What parts of the brain does inflammation affect?
The most prominent parts of the brain that are affected are those that are involved in reward circuitry, motivation, and motor activity, as well as anxiety.
And you measure inflammation primarily with the CRP, the C-reactive protein. Would you say that inflammation is a spectrum from none to mild to severe, Or is it more of a categorical illness, like you're either inflamed or you're not?
Yes. So I think there is a linear relationship between CRP and various measures of connectivity within reward circuitry, for example, or levels of glutamate in the brain. So we do see that those linear relationships there.
Tell us about some other kinds of patients that might have increased inflammation that we should look out for.
Patients that have early life trauma, childhood maltreatment, have higher levels of inflammation. Patients who are under very high levels of stress have high inflammation. The patients that come in that are obese, we can almost immediately say that patient has got increased inflammation. Patients with medical disorders and are undergoing treatments for those disorders. So, for example, cancer patients who've had surgery or radiation, chemotherapy, all associated with tissue damage and destruction, which can activate the immune system. Treatment resistance, these are all associated with higher levels of inflammation.
So I'm getting the picture that inflammation can happen anytime something foreign enters the body, like a wound, an infection, an allergic reaction, or a mutation like cancer. Am I on the right path here?
It's a good point in that people often don't think about inflammation when they're talking about wounding. And they think mostly, well, inflammation is involved in infection. So you're exposed to a pathogen, you have increased inflammation. But it's also important to realize that inflammation is related to any time there's tissue damage or destruction. And if you think about it, just about every illness that we know about and many of the procedures that people are exposed to involve tissue damage and destruction. Think about cardiovascular disease. Think about all the lesions that are in the vasculature up and down the entire body. Each one of those lesions is a tissue damage and destruction. And if you add it all up, you could have some fairly significant increases in inflammation, even though there's not an infection or there's not one gaping wound from a surgical procedure. But clearly, one gaping wound from a surgical procedure will lead to significant inflammation throughout the body.
How does obesity influence inflammation?
With obesity, fat cells grow really quickly. They outstrip their oxygen supply, their blood supply, and the cells die. And whenever, as I said, there's tissue damage or destruction, cell death, that leads to activation of the inflammatory response. And if you actually biopsy fat tissue, especially central obesity and central fat stores, you'll find that these tissues are loaded with inflammatory immune cells, macrophages, that are highly activated in producing large amounts of cytokine.
Is aging an inflammatory process? Like, do we just tend to get more inflamed as we age?
Inflammation believed to be a major source of accelerated aging, not only in terms of the body, but also in terms of the brain and neurodegeneration. There's actually a term that's used. It's called inflammaging.
There's a lot of studies of anti-inflammatories in depression. We ran a review of them a couple months ago in the Carlat Report and counted 36 studies. The main ones they looked at were the NSAIDs, particularly celecoxib, but also aspirin, cytokine inhibitors, statins, which apparently don't just lower cholesterol but also have separate anti-inflammatory effects, monocycline, the antibiotic, pioglitazone, the diabetes med, and the glucocorticoids. The gist of all this data was that anti-inflammatories seemed to help depression, but what struck me was none of these studies looked at the kind of inflammatory biomarkers that you're talking about.
Correct. And so we really don't know. And what you would expect, that in individuals with high inflammation, the drug would work, and in individuals with low inflammation, the drug wouldn't work. Problem in the literature with the use of anti-inflammatory agents to treat depression, the problem is that they treat everybody. And earlier in the interview, I told you that only 30% of people have increased inflammation. So if your COX-2 inhibitor is working for the sample as a whole, what is it actually doing? If we come up with a medication that targets inflammation and that's not quite there yet, it is somewhat of a holy grail in medicine. Inflammation, as you know, is associated with a number of diseases.
So although anti-inflammatories make sense for people with inflammation, Dr. Miller wasn't able to endorse them clinically because we just don't have the evidence. But he did go on in the interview to endorse several psychiatric medications that work better in depression with inflammation. That's all online at the journal. Now, Dr. Miller, outside of those psychiatric medications, what kind of lifestyle advice would you give to someone with inflammation?
The biggest offender in terms of increased inflammation is obesity and sedentary activity. So losing weight would be a very important piece of the puzzle, as would be increasing physical activity, so diet and exercise. The diet that people recommend is the Mediterranean diet as being the most anti-inflammatory of the various diets that are out there. We actually published a study showing that the closer your diet was to Mediterranean diet, the lower your level of interleukin-6 was. So there is data out there suggesting that these diets, particularly the Mediterranean diet, are associated with reduced inflammation as well as reduced depression. The other things that one might want to think about is meditation and yoga. Some of these techniques, Tai Chi, have been associated with increased parasympathetic tone. And we know that activation of the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system is associated with an inhibition of inflammation. And of course, whether or not you're successful, you can determine by going and get your CRP measured after you've initiated whatever lifestyle change that you've decided to initiate. So there really is an opportunity here for people to monitor their inflammatory status and get it down, because we can treat the downstream effects of inflammation with our various psychotropic agents. We talked about that, targeting dopamine, for example. We can do that, but at the end of the day, you really want to reduce your inflammation because it's doing other things to your body other than just influencing chemistry and neural circuits in your brain. It's also influencing your heart and your metabolic.
And there, perhaps, is the practice-changing part of this podcast. In my own practice, I specialize in treatment-resistant depression, and I have had a lot of success with some of the medications that he recommends for inflammation long before I even knew that inflammation was a cause of depression. But what Dr. Miller went on to say is that markers of inflammation and inflammation in the body is not going to go down when we treat these patients with such psychiatric medications and get their depression better. Those markers are only known to go down through the lifestyle changes. So what that means for me is two things. When I see patients who have signs of inflammation and got better on those kinds of medications, I now need to speak to them that these medicines might be making them feel better and more motivated and driven, but they're not necessarily treating the inflammation in their body, and we need to do something about their lifestyle. Of course, we would first check their CRP to see if they indeed have inflammation. After describing the lifestyle options to them, I'll tell the patient to let me know when they've started the lifestyle changes, because we'll give it a couple months, 3 to 6 months, and check their CRP again to see if the inflammation is going down. This provides a unique external motivator for them to make those changes, and it also gives a little incentive for them to be honest with me about whether they're doing it.
Andrew Miller is the William P. Timmy Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Emory University, where he also serves as the Vice Chair of Psychiatric Research and Director of the Behavioral Immunology Program. His full interview is online at thecarlattereport.com. It includes two very useful charts. One lists all the psychiatric treatments that have evidence to work better in inflammatory depression, 4 medications, 3 natural treatments, and 6 lifestyle and psychotherapy approaches. The other is a list of 8 signs that your depressed patient might have inflammation, with directions for how to order and interpret the CRP.
Our podcast listeners can get $30 off their first year's subscription to that site with the promo code PODCAST in all caps.
And that helps us keep the Carlatt Report free from the influence of advertisers, industry donors, and all other sorts of entanglements.